This is the rehearsal for the Last Stand at Little Bighorn panel at Richard Hugo House at the James Welch celebration. One of the unforeseen consequences of serving my time at the UW to get a PhD in the history of the American West all those years ago is that I would one day be sitting here with the assignment of mentioning James Welch and George Armstrong Custer in the same breath. Maybe grad school didn't deplete my common sense entirely, though, because the more I looked at this, the more it seemed it would be a better idea for me to draw separate breaths. So, let me offer a little thinking out loud on a destiny-fingered officer of the 7th Cavalry, with the warning that I did not major in Custer at the UW, and then a quick few closer-to-home thoughts about the writer who was Jim. There are no doubt people in this audience who have more closely parsed out the Custer career than I can ever begin to. But it does appear to me, in the case of Custer, that not for the first time, someone questing after something got too far out onto the plains of the West and lost his bearings. Specifically, Custer seems to have forgotten the military lessons and even tactics from his considerable Civil War career. Custer, remember, did not become a general for his prowess in fighting Indians before one misstep at the Little Bighorn. He received a battlefield commission to that rank at age 23 as a cavalry leader during the drawn-out fight between the Union and the Confederacy, the American Civil War. And, call him a loose cannon if you will, he did play a part in grinding down Southern forces in the fateful weeks before the war ended at the Appomattox Courthouse. The hard-driving Union commander of cavalry, Phil Sheridan, used Custer as one of his hammers. An eyewitness once during this heard Sheridan give Custer his orders in these words, "You understand? I want you to give it to him." Custer gave it to him, and not always with wild cavalry charges. He was flexible enough to dismount most of his men at the important Battle of Waynesboro in the vital last chapter of the war and overrun the Confederate breastworks there. But in the West, a dozen years later, Custer seems to have forgotten the obvious in that triumph of the populous industrious North over the outmanned South. That, as Voltaire puckishly said in another context, God tends to be on the side of the big battalions. Famously or infamously, Custer divided his troops before going into battle with the Little Bighorn. Nor did he remember the Civil War lessons about superior firepower. He declined to take along with his cavalry troop 4 Gatling guns, early prototypes of machine guns, available at his headquarters, even though they were a model designed to be dismantled and carried on pack mules. Yet if Custer went into battle that June afternoon in 1876 as a man unmoored from his own military footings, the moment perversely provided him lasting fame. The premier historian of the American West, Richard White, suggests, quote, "Probably no incident in Western history entered into national myth more quickly than Custer's last stand," end of quote. I think it's worth looking at the effect of the speed and might of that transmission, the crash of that news into the American consciousness at the time. And this takes just a bit of scene setting. July 4th, 1876, the United States was in full celebration of centennial, and those of us who have been through the bicentennial and state centennial and now the Lewis and Clark celebrations know what a weird talent this country has for hoopla. But the very next day, a telegraphed Associated Press story seeps out of Salt Lake City, saying Custer and his command have been annihilated. The storied victorious generals of the Civil War, William Tecumseh Sherman and Phil Sheridan, who now are in overall charge of fighting Indians in the West, are at the Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia, and they don't believe it. They don't have any official word. Then the morning of July 6, a telegraph operator in Fargo hears the individualistic Morse code tapping of his counterpart in Bismarck on the line. "What's up?" asks Fargo. "Cut us through and listen," Bismarck taps rapidly back. "All the customers are killed." Across the next 2 days, the Bismarck operator J.M. Carnahan jerked the lightning, as telegraphers term their electrically impulsed trade, transmitted some 40,000 words, the length of a novella, on the Custer defeat. From that report and others, the Custer myth misted up from the ink of the mass circulation daily newspapers that were the television and internet of the day. Richard White points out that James Gordon Bennett's New York Herald particularly shouted out Custer's last stand as, quote, "a story useful for denouncing all kinds of enemies of the social order." Bennett, says White, denounced the Sioux as communistic. He compared Indian violence with that of labor radicals, and he made lower-class tramps and vagrants the equivalent of savages, end of quote. Yet, if you look back, even into that same New York Herald, the seeds of the demythification of George Armstrong Custer are also there. It strikes me that it has been largely through the capacities of art, such as Paul and Jim's TV piece here, rather than revisions by historians, that we have begun to catch up in a very long way around to the Custer actualities that have been there from the very start. The next day, after the news of the Custer annihilation reached the East Coast, a New York Herald reporter found another Civil War officer there at the Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia, willing to speak freely. Quote, "The truth about Custer is that he was a pet soldier who had risen not above his merit, but higher than men of equal merit. He fought with Phil Sheridan, and through the patronage of Sheridan, he rose. But while Sheridan liked his valor and his dash, he never trusted his judgment. Custer was always aflame. He had a touch of romance about him. When the war broke out, he used to go about dressed like one of Byron's pirates in the archipelago, waving shining locks, broad flapping sombrero. Rising to high command early in life, he lost the repose necessary to success in high command. But you see, we all liked Custer, did not mind his little freaks in that way any more than we would have minded temper in a woman. We all think, much as we lament Custer, that he sacrificed the 7th Cavalry to ambition and wounded vanity." This particular piece I'm going to read goes back almost all the way of the 25 years I was privileged to have Jim Welch as a friend. In the spring of 1979, I was conscripted into a literary gathering in Missoula called the Who Owns the West Conference. I didn't want to do it. I was deep in the writing of this book, Winter Brothers. But Bill Kittredge said on the phone, "We insist that you come. Everybody's going to be there. We'll even pay Carol's way." So we went. Damned if everybody wasn't there. A.B. Guthrie, Norman MacLean, Dorothy Johnson, and of course Jim, and Dick Hugo, the other wonderful poet, Madeline DeFries. And so I had the experience of conferencing tooth and nail on into the night, every night, then holing up the next morning in an upstairs bedroom close to Rattlesnake Creek to keep working on Winter Brothers. The book, as some of you may know, is a kind of meditation on the diaries of James Gilchrist Swan, a solitary pioneer over on the Olympic Peninsula, who virtually every day between the Civil War and his death at the turn of the 20th century wrote conscientiously of his life and those of the other white Westcomers and the Northwest coastal Native Americans around him. The community of time that I saw there in Swan and his 40 years of diaries found some kind of an echo for me in that Missoula gathering, because when the book was published the next year, my dedication in it reads, "This one is for the Missoula gang, when we owned the West." Some of the 26 co-conspirators I listed beneath that are still conferencing tooth and nail here tonight. Lois Welch and Ripley Hugo and Onyx Smith and Bill Kittredge and Carol Doig. And two others have been here all day long in our memories and utterances, Dick Hugo and Jim Welch. So, one more time for that gang. In this bit from Winter Brothers, James Swan has been collecting stories from the coastal Native Americans, as he loved to do, and he's been talking here to a young chieftain named Walaltalezabai, whose penchant for dressing up drew him among the whites out at Cape Flattery the nickname of Swell. From Swell's tribe, the Macaws, Swan noted down that their version of the sun arrived robustly each morning by thrusting away the stars with his head and trampling night underfoot. Rainbows, they considered, had claws at either end to seize the unwary. Comets and meteors were the luminous souls of dead chiefs. As for the mysterious northern lights that sometimes webbed the sky beyond the Strait of Juan de Fuca, Swell explained them astutely to Swan. "Under that star, many snows sail from here in a canoe, live a race of little men, very strong, who are dressed in skins. They look like Indians, but they are not taller than half the length of my paddle. They can dive down into the sea, catch a seal or a fish with their hands. Their country is very cold, and they live on the ice where they build great fires. And that light is the fires of those little people." Swell, as tutor of about Eskimo life, puts light on something else as well. Along the wilderness that was the North Pacific coastland, more than 500 miles of broken shore from Nea Bay even to southernmost Alaska, and greater distances beyond that to the people of the ice, ideas of that sort must have traveled like thistledown on puffs of breeze. Canoeing tribe and wary touch with canoeing tribe, a seed of story deposited, to be borne along by the next barter trip southward. By the time the Macaws received the story of the miniature icemen of the north, lore had been nurtured into legend. "I recognize such wafts of alchemy, for I live with them as well. A morning in the 1920s, a dozen riders are returning to their home ranches after a weekend rodeo. Whenever the horses' hooves strike the dryness of a Montana country road, dust drifts up until from a distance the group looks like men of smoke. Most of the journey, however, cuts across open sage land, and the slap of the gray tassels of brush against leather chaps competes with their talk of the rodeo bronc. Unexpectedly, the loose troop reins to a halt. Across a stretch of pasture they have always ridden through, a fresh barbed wire fence glints. The owner of the land emerges from a nearby cabin to explain that he intends to plow the ground, but they can no longer go across the field to bee. A rider with a notched scar in the center of his chin, he was my father, grins down at the man, says in his style of half-joke, half-declaration, 'We never saw any place yet we couldn't go.' Turning his horse to the fence, he touches spur to flank, and mount and man pass through the air above the blades of wire. One after another, the others soar after him, like boys on great birds of sorrel, roan, dapple gray. The story and its impromptu anthem of the West's last horseback generation have come down to me on embellishing lips, very much as legends of the Eskimos must have arrived south to swell. The same winds blow spring on all men's dreams, I once read from a folklorist. Whether there were a dozen rodeoers, or just four, whether they all lofted themselves in the barbed wire steeplechase, or just the rider with that starred chin, in the tale as it has whiffed to me, they are 12, and they soar. I was never more glad to be a writer, self-unemployed, customarily at my own keyboard, in a workplace of my own choosing, and with no one to boss me around other than the words waiting in my fingertips, than that first morning when Jean set about turning me into a television performer. That dubious day came in Port Townsend, where we were starting to film Winter Brothers. Or more accurately, I was standing dead center in the middle of a Port Townsend street, dodging the occasional passing car, while desperately trying to recite from memory the lines from my book needed for that scene, with Jean all the while hovering just out of camera range, instructing me to look more relaxed. Next came the scene to be shot in the Port Townsend courthouse, that wonderful old pile of a building which, however, was a tiny bit dim inside. In what I supposed was the natural way of television people, Gene and cameraman Wayne Sowerbeer proceeded to set up enough lighting equipment to illuminate, say, Husky Stadium. As I blinked there in the glare, tried to remember my lines, Gene again encouraging me to look more relaxed, I opened my mouth and the Channel 9 lighting gear blew the fuses for the entire Jefferson County courthouse. With that kind of a launch of my TV career, it did take me a while to figure out just what Jean, in her role as producer, was producing. Did I understand the call letters of the station properly, I wondered? Was it KCTS, or something like KAOS? But I've long since seen that I should not have been so surprised at the strange abracadabra rattled out at me by a sorceress-like blonde woman in places that had never known a TV camera before. Magic does not come easy. Jean and her miraculous blend of empathy and push has given us absolutely magical views and insights of the Pacific Northwest and the larger West that will last and last. In her work and her personality, and my wife Carol and I can testify after 20-some years now of doing half the laughing in inspired evenings with Jean and Walt, in the sparkling quality of her friendship, she has kept faith with the terrain that produced her. The late oracle of Western writing, Wallace Stegner, once called the American West the native home of hope. In her keen-eyed explorations of our region and we its people, by coaxing us and our truths to stand stark and lend light, Jean has been our glorious geographer of that territory of the soul. At the age of 9, and perch her on horseback, regally leading the child cavalry of Scotch Heaven from their homestead shanties to their one-room schoolhouse in 1893. Naturally, I had to know what would happen when that smart, bossy, indomitable girl grew up. That probably tells you at least as much as you want to know about what the book is supposed to be about. So let's get to the actual words. It's now 1925, And after a bit of success singing on early radio stations in the West, Monty Rathbun has made it to New York City. As usual by this hour of morning, Monty was out onto the street for the third time. Habit stirred him awake early to do the chores, even here, two-thirds of the continent away from the double W, and even though the nature of the doing had changed beyond recognition. His first excursion, embarked on while it was still too soon to tell what the pinch of sky between the roof lines held for the day, was always around the corner and a few blocks over to the public school and its playground space out back, where he cinched up the roadwork shoes and ran to keep his singing breath built. At that hour, only a few of the more fly types — Harlem never seemed to have any shortage whatsoever of types — out early or in late on activities that did not bear inquiring about, were around to levy looks at the heavy-shouldered man, a long way from a kid, bounding across the skip rope scuffs. Back to the apartment for a wash-up after that, then gratefully to his big feed of the day, breakfast. He took his meals by the month at the E&B, Earl and B's 24-hour buffet, in a nightlife district nearby. They eat 'em and beat 'em, if he could put away enough grub in the course of 30 days, and he had brought his appetite with him from the ranch. Ham and eggs and unlimited cornbread to set him up for the day. Quite the life if he did say so himself. Steak and eggs for two bits more, on concert days like yesterday. Monty was getting his teeth into New York life in other ways, too. Each day he felt less like some sort of permanent tourist as he strode through the well-heeled neighborhood called Stryver's Row about now. The tree-lined street brimmed with morning-faced people by this hour. Harlem, he was finding, operated as if every little while some signal was given to open a floodgate, and it became the turn of this 10,000 or that to pile out to go to work, to school, to church, to nightlife, to wherever there was maybe another rung on the climb from done beginnings. Every one of those street-set faces, the astonishment still struck Monty as soon as he hit the sidewalk, somewhere on the same prism of color as his. Oh, there were white countenances even here, harness bull cops on the beat and bow-tied owners of stores and theaters mostly, but hardly any in comparison. White raisins in the dark plum cake, all they amounted to here. He thought about this at some level even when he was thinking about anything else. Sometimes after breakfast he would linger on his counter stool just to watch through the big cafe front window the start of the morning rush. The domestics and elevator men and street cleaners and dishwashers and myriad other doers of chores pouring into the L station in order to be on the job downtown when the white world there cranked open for business. And he could not help but marvel at the way things had swung his way. Last year at this time, he had been in their shoes, even if his came with cowboy boot heels and milk cow manure on them. Now, he put on a suit every day of his life, the fanciest of black cloth to perform in at night. And was it any wonder he felt far enough up in the world to tingle when he took his morning constitutional now along Stryver's Row and beyond? Still, there was something more that kept trying to register in him on this particular outing. Feels like the day it'll hit, the rhythm of the notion came to him as steadily as his stride. Feels like the odds are saying to hell with themselves today. He realized he of course did not have a whit of fact to back that up. Luck doesn't let you know beforehand that it is about to change, like the more generous weather. But the impression tingled too much to ignore. Clenched one hand, just from nerves, as he navigated from one block of Tony addresses to the next. His mind played with the idea that maybe there was such a thing as odds mounting up to the point where they vibrated like bees in a hive, sending something off into the air. In any case, He could not shake off the feeling of good fortune about to alight and start tickling him silly. He did not want to even try to shrug that away. He had too many years of his life invested in finally reaching the vicinity of luck. Within a couple of blocks, his daily destination poked up like a smudged thumb. The newsstand, where the ink of headlines practically obliterated the Grey Knapp proprietor within. Exchanging greetings, Motti shopped the array of front pages the newsstand was wreathed in until he spotted the particular one he wanted today. The World. That ought to be ample enough. He handed the vendor the pennies for the newspaper, then a paper dollar for the number he wanted to play. 306 again, how about? Straighter combination, Mr. Rathman. Straight again. Man can strop a razor on what you pick, Mr. Rathman. The old vendor jotted the number in Monty's bet on the cheat sheet, then handed him his slip of paper. How'd it go last night? I'm about to find out. Back in his apartment, though, Monty took his time about that. Over and over, he had told himself he shouldn't still be, but he was smarting from Boston last week, where he'd had a cold and his performance suffered accordingly. Some of the reviews there worked him over practically down to a shoeshine. The crickets. J.J., his manager, pooh-poohed the critics. You leave the crickets to me, Montgomery. Good, sound, logical advice, as far as Monty was concerned. Just impossible to follow. Wasn't the person always going to be curious about what was written about him? Half the people he met in New York lived on that precise curiosity. But he didn't have to let it smack him in the face this very moment. He did his voice exercises first, straightened up his bed, did some mindful dusting, wary in the vicinity of radiators and doorknobs where spark shocks lurked when a person lived on carpets all the time. He came across yesterday's number slip in the dresser drawer under his socks. He wadded it into a tiny ball and put today's in its place. To tell the truth, he would not be surprised if the number never did hit. But it was the luxury he allowed himself, a dollar a day to play the numbers, as much as his month's wages had been on the ranch, and here he didn't even miss it. Still holding off on the newspaper, could not help glancing toward it, its masthead, New York World, expectant on the table. Quite the world, all right. Last night he had walked onto the stage in front of a packed audience of 1,200 at the Aeolian Theater, and tonight's would be no more than 36 at best. Another musicale. The take wasn't great, but J.J. scheduled these with as much care as he did the big hall recitals. People on the inn, society, J.J. called such gatherings. Pulling out his song sheets to make sure they were in the right order, Monty tried to picture the probable musicale scene. A number of Stryver's Rows, own movers and shakers, always adorned the evening's chosen living room, to be sure. But right in there with them mingled the fair-haired downtowners who came up here to Harlem on the lure of the music or their own highly honed curiosity or just because it was a thing to do. He put aside the song sheets, ready for the musicale. All right, it was time. He went over to the table where the newspaper waited. He folded the paper back, scanning until he spotted the review, read it, chewing his lip, read it again, a lot more slowly. Shaking his head to clarify the imprint of the words, even though he knew what they meant, he ripped the piece out of the paper as though it would get loose in the room and do something more to him. Then he caught his breath, sat down to write to Susan.